That means we may begin and go on from where we stopped is that Stephen, seeing the vision of his dead mother, that he lifts his stock, his ash plant, and smashes the chandelier, which is probably a very cheap affair, and then he rushes out with a great gesture, as in Wagner, where Siegfried's sword is called Nothung. Looks a bit like nothing also on the page. And then Stephen is out. So we have, Bella says, after him, and that's where we pick up then.
Bella screams, "After him!" The two whores rush to the hall doors. Lynch and Kitty and Zoe stampede from the room. They talk excitedly. Bloom follows, returns. The whores, jammed in the doorway, pointing, "Down there!" Zoe, pointing, "There! There's something up!" Bella, "Who pays for the lamp?" She seizes Bloom's coattail. "There! You were with him! The lamp's broken!" Bloom rushes to the hall, rushes back. "What lamp, woman?" A whore. "He tore his coat!" Bella, her eyes hard with anger and cupidity, points. "Who's to pay for that? 10 shillings! You're a witness!" Bloom snatches up Stephen's ashband. "Me? 10 shillings? Hadn't you lifted enough off him? Didn't he?" Bella loudly. "Here, none of your tall talk. This isn't a brothel, a 10-shilling house." Bloom, his hand under the lamp, pulls the chain. Pulling the gas jet lights up a crushed mauve purple shade. He raises the ashplant. "Only the chimney's broken. Here is all he..." Bella shrinks back and screams. "Jesus, don't!" Bloom, warding off a blow, "to show you how he hit the paper. There's not a sixpence worth of damage done. 10 shillings. Florrie, with a glass of water, enters. "Where is he?" Bella, "Do you want me to call the police?" Bloom, "Oh, I know, bulldog on the premises, but he's a Trinity student. Patrons of your establishment. Gentlemen that pay the rent." It makes a Masonic sign. "Know what I mean? Nephew of the Vice Chancellor. You don't want a scandal." Bella, angrily, "Trinity, coming down here, ragging after the boat races and paying nothing. Are you my commander here? Where is he? I'll charge him, disgrace him, I will." She shouts, "Zoe! Zoe!" Bloom, urgently, "And if it were your own son in Oxford," warningly, "I know." Bella, almost speechless, "Who are you, incog?" Zoe, in the doorway, "There's a row on." Bloom, "What? Where?" He throws a shilling on the table and shouts, "That's for the chimney. Where? I need mountain air." He hurries out to the hall. The whores point. Florrie follows, spilling water from a tilted tumbler. On the doorstep, all the whores, clustered, talk volubly, pointing to the right where the fog has cleared off. From the left arrives a jingling hackney car. It slows too in front of the house. Bloom at the hall door perceives Corny Keller, who is about to dismount from the car with two silent letters. He averts his face. Bella, from within the hall, urges on her whores. They blow icky-licky-sticky-yum-yum kisses. Corny Keller replies with a ghostly, lewd smile. The silent letters turn to pay the jarvey. Zoe and Kitty still point right. Bloom, parting them swiftly, draws his caliph's hood and poncho and hurries down the steps with sideways face. Incog Harun al-Rashid. He flits behind the silent ledgers and hastens on by the railings with fleet step of a pard, strewing the drag behind him, torn envelopes drenched in aniseed. The ashplant marks his stride. A pack of bloodhounds, led by Hornblower of Trinity, brandishing a dog whip and tallyho cap and an old pair of grey trousers, follows from afar, picking up the scent. Nearer, baying, panting, at fault, breaking away, throwing their tongues, biting his heels, leaping at his tail. He walks, runs, zigzags, gallops, lugs laid back. He is pelted with gravel, cabbage stumps, biscuit boxes, eggs, potatoes, dead codfish, woman slipper slappers. After him, fresh found, the hue and cry, zigzag, gallops, and hot pursuit of follow my leader. 65C, 66C, Night Watch, John Henry Menton, Wisdom Healy, V.B. Dillon, Councillor Danetti, Alexander Keyes, Larry O'Rourke, Joe Cuff, Mrs. O'Dowd, Pisser Burke, the nameless one, Mrs. Reardon, the citizen, Gary Owen, what do you call him? Strange face, fellow that's like, saw him before, chap with Chris Callanan, Sir Charles Cameron, Benjamin Dollard, Lenehan, Bartell Darcy, Joe Hines, Red Murray, Editor Braden, T.M. Healy, Mr. Justice Fitzgibbon, John Howard Parnell, the Reverend Tin Salmon, Professor Jolie, Mrs. Breen, Dennis Breen, Theodore Purefoy, Mina Purefoy, the Westland Road Postmistress, C.P. McCoy, friend of Lyons, Hoppy Holohan, man in the street, other man in the street, football boots, pug-nosed driver, rich Protestant lady, Davy Byrne, Mrs. Ellen McGuinness, Mrs. Joe Gallagher, George Lidwell, Jimmy Henry on corn, Superintendent Larracy, Father Cowley, Crofton out of the Collector Generals, Dan Dawson, dental surgeon Bloom with tweezers, Mrs. Bob Doran, Mrs. Kennefic, Mrs. Wise Nolan, John Wise Nolan, Handsome married woman rubbed against white behind a Trotsky tram. The bookseller of Sweets of Sin. Miss Doobiedad and She Did Bedad. Madame's Gerald and Stanislas Morin of Roebuck. The managing clerk of Drimmies. Colonel Hayes, Mastiansky, Citron, Penrose, Erin Figartner, Moses Herzog, Michael E. Geraghty, Inspector Troy, Mrs. Galbraith, the constable off Ector Street Corner, old Dr. Brady with stethoscope, the mystery man on the beach, a retriever, Mrs. Miriam Darndrade, and all her lovers. The hue and cry, helter skelter, pelter welter. He's Bloom, stop!
Oh, good.
Bloom, stop a robber, hi, stop him on the corner!
Good. Yeah, hiccups after him, Bella says. Two whores rush to the hall doors. Lynch and Kitty, obviously Lynch and the prostitute Kitty, they seem to be together. And Zoe stampede from the room. They talk excitedly. Bloom follows, returns. The whole time the doorway point down there. Zoe pointing there. There's something up outside. Then Bella comes to Bloom. Who pays for the lamp? She sees it. Bloom's outer coattail. There, you are with him. The lamp's broken. Bloom rushes to the hall, rushes back. What lamp, woman? And you see that here Bloom reasserts himself. And that's probably real. The whore, he tore his coat. Bella, her eyes hardly anger and cupidity points. Who's to pay for that? 10 shillings. You're a witness. Bloom snatches up Stephen's ash plant. Me? 10 shillings? Haven't you lived yet? Enough of him? Didn't he? Bella loudly. Yeah, none of your talk. This isn't a brothel, a 10-shilling house. That's obviously something better. So we can see 10 shillings was something. Bloom, his hand on the lamp, pulls the chain, pulling. The gas head lights up a crushed mauve purple shade. So it still gives light. He raises the ash prompt. Only the chimney's broken. Here is all the... Now he raises the ash prompt, and that's the equivalent in the Odyssey when Odysseus comes to Circe, who wants to change him like the others. He lifts his sword, and at this point, the sorceress knows that there's somebody stronger and things like that. And at this moment, they become lovers. So that is when Odysseus refuses to be changed and takes over. And here Bloom, too, suddenly he's in command. Bella shrinks back and screams, Jesus, don't. Bloom, warding off a blow, to show you how we hit the paper. There's not 6 penny worth of damage, 10 shillings. Florrie, with a glass of water, enters. Where is he? Bella, do you want me to call the police? Bloom, oh, I know. Bulldog on the premises. There seems to be somebody there. But he's a Trinity student, which of course isn't correct. Stephen, then as a Protestant, could never be a student in Trinity. But that's more posh, more upper class. Patrons of the establishment, and it seems from what I've been told, that medical students from Trinity were often quite welcome because they could give sort of cheap advice. Gentlemen that pays the rent. That would be somebody in the brothel who keeps it going. But a gentleman that pays the rent is also a phrase for the pig, because Irish peasants often had only one pig, and that was their son. And so the pigs were the gentlemen that paid the rent. Then Bloom makes another Masonic sign. Know what I mean? nephew of the Vice Chancellor. So Bloom says, Stephen is somebody highly connected. You don't want to scandal him. That angry Trinity coming down here ragging after the boat races. You know, when the boat races are Cambridge against Oxford, there's always some celebration and riot afterwards. I'm paying nothing. Are you my commander here? Where is he? I'll charge him. Disgrace him. So, Zoe, Bloom urgently. And if it were your own son in Oxford, why no? Now, it seems that some of these madams who owned an establishment were quite well off, and they could afford to have their sons studying at Oxford. I know. Bella, who are you in Cork? Now, the funny thing is, in Cork, it is incognito for intoxicated. I don't believe this for a word. I think there's some policeman incognito. Zoe, there's a row on. Bloom, what? Where? He throws a shilling in the table and shouts, that's for the chimney. So the toilet says, well, I need mountain wear. And then he rushes out, and there's a whole group of imaginary people. They're not there, of course. He hurries out through the hall. The horse point. Floyd follows, spilling water from her tilted jumbler. On the doorsteps, all the whores clustered talk volubly, pointing to the right where the fog has cleared off. From the left arrives a jingling hackney car. So it slows in front of the house. Bloom at the hall door perceives Corny Keller, the funeral undertaker, who we know also does other business, and who may actually be a police stout in connection with the police. Corny Keller, who is about to dismount from his car with two silent lechers. So he brings two more clients to the brothel area. He averts his face. Of course, you don't want to be seen. Bella, from within the hall, urges on her horse. They blow icky, licky, sticky, yum, yum kisses. Yum, yum. Corny Keller replies with a ghostly, lewd smile. The silent lechers turn to pay the jarvey. And that is probably reality. Zoe and Kitty still point right. Bloom, parting them swiftly, draws his caliph's hood, and Poncoin hurries down the steps with sideways face so as not to be recognized by Connor. In Cork, incognito, Harun al-Rashid. So that is what it is. Harun al-Rashid in the 31 Nights is known that he disguised incognito, went out to the people to find out how they talk about him. So that is a famous somebody who is disguised. He flits behind the silent lectures and hastens on by the railings with a fleet step of a part. Strewing the drag behind him, in any seat, this is when you're in a fox hunt, when you have some aniseed across the trail, the hounds lose their orientation, their sense of smell. So it's the foxhound idea. Envelopes drenched in aniseed. The aspirant marks his stride. Stephen has left his aspirant and brings it. A black of pathounds. So this is a foxhound led by Hornblower of Trinity. Hornblower was a man who guarded the back exit of Trinity. And there used to be, and I still saw one, dressed in hunting costumes of the 18th century. Hornblower brandishing a dog whip in tally-ho cap, that tally-ho is hunting, and an old pair of grey trousers, fellows from far, picking up the scent. That's what the fox does. Nearer, baying, hounds, panting at fault. At fault is if when they lose the smell of the thing. Breaking away, throwing their tongues, biting his heels, leaping at his tail. He walks, runs, zigzags like a hare, gallops, lurches laid back, lurches or shells. What is the outer part of the ear? Boom. He's pelted with gravel, cabbage stumps, biscuit boxes, we remember the biscuit box, eggs, potatoes, dead codfish, woman's slipper slapper. And you know, throwing a shoe at somebody is usually an insult. After him, Fresh found the hue and cry. The hue and cry is when there's a thief running away, you have to join the hue and cry. That is the people, the crowd that runs after the thief, hue and cry. Hue is an old French word also for shouting. You and cry. Zigzag gallops in hot pursuit of follow my leader. That is a party game when you obviously have to follow something. 65C, 66C, night watch, they have numbers. And then you have a list of people that Bloom met during the day. So it's in his imagination. John Henry Menton. Wisdom Healy, the stationer, his former employer. V.B. Dillon, former landlord, Lord Mayor. Councillor Nettie from the newspaper. Alexander Keyes, that is the advertisement. Larry O'Rourke, that's the pub around the corner. Joe Cuff, Bloom's employer in the cattle market. Mrs. O'Dowd, who owned the City Arms Hotel, Fisher Burke, who resided there, the nameless one, that is probably in our context the one who tells the story of the Cyclops chapter, but the nameless one is also a poem by Charles Mangan. One, Mrs. Reardon, she's the Catholic woman that we know from a portrait. The citizen, Gary Owen, the dog. And then, what do you call him? Strange face. Fellow, that's like. So, people you can't recognize. Saw him before. Chap with. And then you come to Chris Callinan, Sir Charles Cameron, Benjamin Dollett, the singer, Lenehan, Bartel Darcy, a tenor, Joe Hines, the newspaper man, Red Murray, Editor Braden from News, T.M. Healy, who was a politician, hated because he sided against Parnell long ago. Mr. Justice Fitzgibbon, an important person, John Howard Parnell, the brother of the dead Parnell, the Reverend Tin Salmon, Bloom passed in the 8th chapter, the house of the Provost of Trinity, whose name was George Salmon, and Bloom thought of salmon eating and thought of his in his house, he's like tinned salmon. So here his name is Tint. Professor Jolie, the astronomer, Mrs. Breen, Dennis Breen, he's met them in the city, Theodore Purefoy, Mina Purefoy, who gave birth to a child, the Westland Road postmistress, who gave him the letter, C.P. McCoy, he talks to, friend of Ryan's, Hoppy Holland, another character, man in the street, other man in the street, football boots, pug-nosed driver, that is the driver of the tram that blocked Bloom's view earlier on, Davy Byrne, pub keeper, Mrs. Ellen McGuinness, the pawnbroker, Mrs. Joe Gallagher, George Lidwell, the lawyer, Jimmy Henry on corns, we met them all before, Superintendent Larracy for the Cowley, Drofton and the Collector General, Dan Dawson, who wrote that speech, dental surgeon Bloom, there was a Bloom, a dentist in Dublin, with tweezers. Mrs. Bob Doran, who was drunk. Mrs. Kennethick, we haven't heard of her before. Mrs. Wise Nolan, John Wise Nolan, he was in Cyclops. And then handsome married woman rubbed against wide between hide in Clonsey tram. That is a woman in a full tram that was brushed again. There's a term for that kind of perversion. Bookseller, Sweet of Sin, Miss Dubidat. This is a Huguenot name, and Bloom earlier on thought there is a Miss Dubidat in Killiney, and the joke is Miss Dubidat, and she did be that. Irish kind of joke. Madams Gerald and Stannis of Moran of Roebuck, we don't know them. The Matinian Clerk of Drimmis, Colonel Hayes, Mastiansky, Citron. These are Jews from the old Jewish area in Dublin. Penrose, a man who looked through the windows. Aaron Figatner has a shop. Moses Herzog, Michael Geraghty. These are the contestants in Cyclops. Inspector Troy from the police, Mrs. Galbraith, the constable of Eccles Street Corner, old Dr. Brady with stethoscope, the mystery man on the beach that Bloom thought about, a retriever, Mrs. Miriam Dandrade and all her lovers. These are all memories, and he imagines them there, a whole crowd. So the human cry goes, helter skelter, that's all in a crowd, pelter welter. So here's Bloom, stop Bloom, stop a Bloom, stop a robber, hi hi, stop him on the corner. So a human cry is people who are supposed to run after a thief. And that is, I think, where we stop now.
Corner of Beaver Street, beneath the scaffolding, Bloom, panting, stops on the fringe of the noisy, quarrelling knot. A lot, not knowing a jot, what high row and wrangle from the who-what brawl altogether. Stephen, with elaborate gestures, breathing deeply and slowly. You are my guests, the uninvited, by virtue of the 5th of George and 7th of Edward, history to blame, fabled by mothers of memory. Private Car, to Sissy Caffrey. Was he insulting you? Stephen, addressed her in vocative feminine, probably neuter, ungenitive voices. No, he didn't. The girl's telling lies. He was in Mrs. Cohen's. What's up? Soldiers and civilians. Sissy Caffrey, I was in company with the soldiers and they left me to do, you know, and the young man ran up behind me, but I'm faithful to the man that's treating me, though I'm only a shilling whore. Stephen catches sight of Kitty's and Lynch's heads. Hail Sisyphus! He points to himself and the others. Poetic? Neo-poetic. Voices. She's faithful, the man. Sissy Caffrey. Yes, to go with him and me with the soldier friend. Private Compton. He doesn't half want a thick ear, the blighter. Biff him one, Harry. Private Carr to Sissy. Was he insulting you while me and him was having a piss? Lord Tennyson, in Union Jack blazer and cricket flannels, bareheaded, flowing bearded. There's not a reason why. Private Compton. Biff him, Harry. Stephen to Private Compton. I don't know your name, but you are quite right. Dr. Swift says one man in armour will beat 10 men in their shirts. Shirt is synecdoche, part for the whole. Sissy Caffrey to the crowd. No, I was with the private. Stephen, amiably. Why not? The bold soldier boy. In my opinion, every lady, for example. private car, his cap awry, advancing to Stephen. "Say, how would it be, Governor, if I was to bash in your jaw?" Stephen looks up in the sky. "How? Very unpleasant. Noble art of self-pretense. Personally, I detest action." He waves his hand. "Hand hurts me slightly. Enfin, ce sont vos soignons." To Sissy Caffrey. "Some trouble is on here. What is it precisely?" Dolly Gray, from her balcony, waves her handkerchief, giving the sign of the heroine of Jericho.
"Rahab, cook son, goodbye. Safe bound to Dolly. Dream of the girl you left behind, and she will dream of you."
The soldiers turn their swimming eyes. Bloom, elbowing through the crowd, plucks Stephen's sleeve vigorously. "Come now, Professor, that car man is waiting." Stephen turns. "Eh?" He disengages himself.
"Why should I not speak to him or to any human being who walks upright upon this oblate orange?"
He points his finger. "I'm not afraid of what I can talk to if I see his eye. Retaining the perpendicular." He staggers a pace back. Bloom, propping him. "Retain your own." Stephen laughs emptily. "My center of gravity is displaced. I have forgotten the trick. Let us sit down somewhere and discuss. Struggle for life is the law of existence, but modern philanderists, notably the Tsar and the King of England, have invented arbitration." He taps his brow. "But in here it is I must kill the priest and the king." Biddy the clap.
"Did you hear what the professor said? He's the professor out of the college."
Conti Kate.
"I did. I heard that."
Biddy the clap.
"He expresses himself with much marked refinement, the phraseology."
Conti Kate.
"Indeed, yes. And at the same time, with such apposite trenchancy."
Private Carr pulls himself free and comes forward.
"What's that you're saying about my king?"
Edward the Seventh appears in an archway. He wears a white jersey on which an image of the Sacred Heart is stitched, with the insignia of Garter and Thistle, Golden Fleece, Elephant of Denmark, Skinner's and Proben's Horse, Lincoln's Inn Venture, an ancient and honourable artillery company of Massachusetts. He sucks a red jujube. He is robed as a grand elect, perfect and sublime mason, with trowel and apron, marked Made in Germany. In his left hand, he holds a plasterer's bucket, on which is printed, Défense de Urinay. A roar of welcome greets him. Edward the Seventh, slowly, solemnly, but indistinctly,
"Peace, perfect peace. For identification, bucket in my hand. Cheerio, boys."
He turns to his subjects.
"We've come here to witness a clean, straight fight, and we heartily wish both men the best of good luck. Mahatma Carr are back."
He shakes hands with Private Carr, Private Compton, Stephen, Bloom, and Lynch. General applause. Edward the Seventh lifts the bucket graciously in acknowledgement. Private Carr to Stephen.
"Say it again."
Stephen, nervous, friendly, pulls himself up.
"I understand your point of view, though I have no king myself for the moment. This is the age of patent medicine. A discussion is difficult down here, but this is the point. You die for your country, suppose."
He places his arm on Private Carr's sleeve.
"Not that I wish it for you, but I say, let my country die for me. Up to the present, it has done so. I don't want to die. Damn death. Long live life."
Edward the Seventh levitates over heaps of slain in the garb and with the halo of joking Jesus, a white jujube in his phosphorescent face.
"My methods are new and are causing surprise. To make the blind see, I throw dust in their eyes."
Stephen,
"Kings and unicorns."
He falls back a pace.
"Come somewhere and we'll..." "What was that girl saying?"
Private Compton,
"Hey, Harry, give him a kick in the knackers. Stick right into Jerry."
Bloom, to the private softly. "He doesn't know what he's saying. Taking a little more than is good for him. Absinthe, the green-eyed monster. I know him. He's a gentleman, a poet. It's all right." Stephen nods, smiling and laughing.
"Gentlemen, patriot, scholar, and judge of imposters."
Private Carr.
"I don't give a bugger who he is."
Private Compton.
"We don't give a bugger who he is."
Stephen. "I seem to annoy them. Green rag to a bull." Kevin Egan of Paris, in black Spanish tassel shirt and Peeper Day boy's hat, signs to Stephen. Kevin Egan.
"Hello, bonjour. De vieille ogresse with the donjon."
Patrice Egan peeps from behind, his rabid face nibbling a quince leaf. Patrice.
"Socialiste!"
Don Emile Patrizio Franz Rupert Pope Hennessy. In medieval hauberk, two wild geese for lant on his helm, with noble indignation, points a mailed hand against the privates.
"Werf those eeks to Forbolton. Big grand porcos of John Yellow's Tordos, covered of gravy."
Bloom to Stephen. "Come home. You'll get into trouble." Stephen, swaying.
"I don't avoid it. He provokes my intelligence."
Biddy the clap.
"One immediately observes that he is of patrician lineage."
the virago. Green above the red, says he, wolf tone. The board. The red's as good as the green, and better. Up the soldiers, up King Edward. A rough laughs. Aye, hands up to the west. The citizen, with a huge emerald muffler and shillelagh, calls,
may the god of wolves send down a cove with teeth as sharp as razors to slit the throat of the English dogs that hanged our Irish leaders.
The croppy boy, the rope noose around his neck, gripes in his issuing bowels with both hands.
I bear no hate to a living thing, but love my country beyond the king.
No. We're outside now. At the corner of Beaver Street, that's right, Baker. Beneath the scaffolding, Bloom, panting, stops on the fringe of the noisy, quarrelling knot. A lot not knowing a jot, lot not, jot, there's a kind of rhyming thing going on, a jot, what hi-hi, row and wrangle round the what brawl all together. It's a bit confused here. Now he finds there Stephen engaged in a quarrel with the two British soldiers. Stephen doesn't realize that he's in any kind of danger. With elaborate gestures, breathing deeply and slowly, you're my guests, the uninvited. British soldiers, of course, are not invited in Ireland. By virtue of the 5th of George and the 7th of Edward, kings. History is to blame, an echo of the first chapter. Fable thy mothers of memory. That is the beginning of the second chapter. History is what has been recorded, or been said. Fabled, turned into a story. The mothers of memory are the muses. They remember everything. So that goes back there. Everything goes back to something. Private Carr. And Private Carr now is, I said that before, is that man from the British consulate in Zurich who was enlisted in a play in the Kaufleuten. To play Oscar Wilde dandy, and he and Joyce quarrelled. Carr charged for expenses, clothes and things like that, and they fell out, and they had a case in the Zurich Bezirksgericht. It ended in a way as a draw, but Joyce in a way used the name of his opponent to put him in here and give him a bad name. As I often said, that is a technique that Dante did. You can, if you're a writer of some importance, you can put your enemy into hell or have them murdered or whatever, or give them bad characters. So this is a Zurich echo. Private Carr to Sissy Catherine. Was he insulting you? Stephen. And you see, Stephen talks something that the soldiers and the horse and the round people probably would not follow, addressed in the vocative feminine. You know, when you address something, that's the vocative. Probably neuter. Words can be feminine, masculine, or neuter. Probably neuter. And genitive. So he talks grammar to them. Vocative, neuter, genitive and things like that. Why is he? No, he didn't. The girl's telling lies. He wasn't Mrs. Cohen's. What's up? Soldiers and civilians, the crowd, ordinary Irish people, would probably not like the British soldiers. Whereas those engaged in the prostitution trade, they would like them because they bring money. He was in Mr. Cohen's. What's up? Soldiers and civilians. insisted Cuffrey. I was in company with soldiers, and they left me to do, you know, and the young man ran up behind me. So it seems, she says, she has been molested by Stephen, which my taste isn't particularly likely, but you don't know. But I'm faithful, the metal man that's treating me, though I'm only a shilling whore. Tells you something about prices. Stephen catches sight of Kitty's and Lynch's heads. Kitty and Lynch seem to be together. Hail, Sisyphus, the man who rolled the boulder to the top of the hill, and it came back. He points to himself and the others, poetic, neo-poetic. What should I say? She's faithful, the man. Yes, you go with him, and me with a soldier friend. And now Private Compton, who is a kind of company assistant to Picard, and they speak, and you see Joyce brings that, they speak British English. He doesn't want half a stick, want a figure, the blighter. Biff him one, Harry. Private Carter said, was he insulting you while me and him was having a piss? And then we have Lord Tennyson, the poet, in Union Jack blazer and cricket flannels. You may remember that Lord Tennyson was called Lawn Tennyson. And here he's not playing tennis, he's playing cricket. Bareheaded, flowing bearded, there's no to reason why. And that's from a famous poem by Tennyson of a British artillery regiment who ran right into the Russian cannons, and Tennyson wrote the poet, the soldiers, there's not to reason why. They just obey commands and they don't have to judge it. So this is a famous quotation. Private Compton, Biff him, Harry. Stephen, to Private Compton, I don't know your name, but you're quite right. Then he quotes again, Dr. Swift says one man in armour, like the soldiers, will beat 10 men in their shirts. Shirt is synecdoche, part for the whole. That is a rhetorical term, a part for the whole. As I say, that's not the language that would reach soldiers. But then Stephen, and that is a kind of comfort for us, perhaps, Stephen never adapts his speech to his listeners. Yeah. It's a bit like that. So he doesn't connect. Part for the whole. Says he have to cry. No, I was with a private. Stephen amiably, why not? The bold soldier boy, that's an Irish song. In my opinion, every lady, for example, Private Corps, his cap awry, advancing to Stephen, say, how would you be governor if I wasn't a bash in your jaw? Stephen looks up in the sky, how very unpleasant. Noble art of self-pretense. You know, the noble art of self-defense. And yet, self-pretense. Personally, I detect action. He waves his hand. Hand hurts me slightly. Un force sans bourgeonio, I think that is seems to say it's your problem, not mine. C'est un bourgeonio. I don't know. To Sissy Cavalier, some trouble is on here. What is it precisely? You see, Stephen is quite unaware of what's going on. And then Dolly Gray. Now, Dolly Gray is a song, a heroine song, Dolly Gray, from the Boer War. The girl I left behind me, you know, soldiers always sing about the women that are waiting for them. From a balcony, waves a handkerchief, giving the sign of the heroine of Jericho. That's another Masonic Freemason term. Because that's Rahab Cooks. Son of Rahab, I have to look up. This goes to the Bible, to the Joshua, the book of the Bible, has to do something, which is now too complicated to go into. Anyone, the soldiers wouldn't know what he's talking about. Rob Cooks, son, goodbye. This is quite complicated. During the Boer War, Kipling, of course, in a colonial empire and all of that, he wrote a poem about Cooks raising money for the soldiers. Cook's son, safe home to Dolly. Dolly, the girl I left behind him. So that is Boer War songs. That would be quite recent. That's again a fantasy. The soldiers turn their swimming eyes. I think it's patriotism that makes them think. Bloom. Bloom now is coming. Elbowing through the crowd, plucks Stephen's sleeve vigorously. Come now, Professor. That Carmen is waiting, so he calls him Professor. Stephen turned, eh? He disengages himself. Stephen doesn't like to have his arm touched. Why should I not speak to him or any human being who walks upright upon this oblate orange? He points his finger. I am not afraid of what I can talk to if I see his eyes. Returning the perpendicular, standing upright, he staggers back, Bloom, propping him. Retain your own, because Stephen is quite drunk. Stephen laughs emptily. My center of gravity is displaced. I've forgotten the trick. Let us sit down somewhere and discuss. Struggle for life is your law of existence, Darwinism, but modern Phil-Ironists, those are people who love peace, because, as you know, after 10 years, the world war, the first, was brewing and showing on the horizon, and there were attempts between France and Russia to have a kind of a contract. Notably, the Tsar and the King of England have invented arbitration, not war. He taps his brow. But in here, I must kill the priest and the king, kind of psychology. And now you have some character. Biddy the clap. Clap is venereal disease. Gonorrhea. Did you hear what the professor said? He's a professor out of the college. Cunty Kate. I did, I heard that. And then these two obviously quite vulgar women by their names. Look how I express. He expresses himself with much marked refinement of phraseology. It's not the register that you want. Do you expect to hear from them? And Cunty Kate says, indeed, yes. And at the same time with such opposite trenchancy. You see how they have an upper class diction here that you don't expect. Private Carr pulls himself free and comes forward. What's that you're saying about my king? And then Edward VII, the king then, King Edward, appears in an archway. He wears a white jersey on which an image of the Sacred Heart is stitched. Now, the Sacred Heart is a Catholic order, and you know, and the Protestant King of England would certainly not have this. But the rest is with the insignia of the garter and thistle, golden fleece, elf and Denmark skin of purpose, horse of England, bender engine, all of it. These are all things that belong to the King of England. The Knight of the Garter, you know, the Onisuaki Malipos, then the Golden Fleece, is alternate order. The elephant of Denmark is another order. Stinnes and Probyn's horse, the cavalry regiment, Lincoln's adventure. So these are all, I think, real titles that the king would have. And that all has, of course, a historical past. And the ancient honorable tradition in Boston. Yeah. So I don't. Then he sucks a red jujube, and that is at the beginning of the 8th chapter. Bloom was looking into a candy shop window, where there, and he thought of God Save the King, King sitting on his throne, sucking red jujubes, some candies. He's robed as a grand elect, perfect sublime mason. That's Freemasonry come again, with trowel and apron marked made in Germany. In his left hand, he holds a plaster bucket on which is printed, Défense du Réné. Now, can you imagine, after the World War, in 1922, when the book was published in Paris, how it would have been received in England when the present king has the Défense du Réné. I mean, that would be enough to bring the book to court. Now, why is Edward VII there? Because as the Prince of Wales, and maybe not later, he was known by a few to be a visitor to the Dublin brothels. So that's why Joyce brings him here, which, of course, would not improve the situation of the book in an English court. Edward VII, slowly, solemnly, and distinctively. Peace, perfect peace. That was a slogan at the time. Wait a moment. Peace, perfect peace was a hymn. Peace, perfect peace. Around that time. For a genuine bucket in my hand. Cheerio, boys. He turned to his subject. We have come here to witness a clean, straight fight, and we heartily wish both men the best of good luck. It's like a kind of fight. Then he says, Mark Makara Buck. That is a kind of hocus pocus secret formula. What they say here is in Arabic, it's not exact, of course. You are a sly one, your father. It's a kind of a magic formula, that kind of thing. Then he shakes hands with Private Cartwright, Compton, Stephen Bloom, and Lynch. They're preparing for a fight. General applause. Edward VII lifts his bucket gracefully in acknowledgement. Private Carr to Stephen. Say it again. Stevens, nervous, friendly, pulled himself up. I myself believe that what Stephen says should be spoken more slowly, more mutely, than not shouted as they do in this thing. I understand your point of view, though I have no king myself for the moment. This is the age of patent medicine. The discussion is difficult down here, but this is the point. You die for your country, suppose. He places his arm on her sleeve. Not that I wish it for you, but I say, let my country die for me. Up to the present, it has done so. I don't want to die. Damn death. Long live life. And Edward VII levitates. That is when you float without falling. Over a heap of slain in the garb and with a halo of joking Jesus, a white judub in his phosphorescent face. So the joking Jesus was the blasphemous poem that Morrigan sang in the first chapter. Page 22 for those who have the heavens. My methods are new and are causing surprise to make the blind see I throw dust in their eyes. Stephen, kings and unicorns. Kings and unicorns. The lion and the unicorn are fighting for the crown. The lion beat the roar in the town. So this is a kind of echo. He falls back a pace. Come somewhere and will. What was the girl saying? Private Compton. Hey, Harry, give him a kick in the knackers. Testicles. Stick into one, Jerry. Bloom, to the private softly. He doesn't know what he's saying. Taking a little more than is good for him. Absinthe. He has been drinking absinthe, we know. The green-eyed monster. Now, Absinthe is called green-eyed because there's a green variant of it. But the green-eyed monster is from Macbeth. Beware of jealousy, it is a green-eyed monster. I know him. He's a gentleman, a poet. It's all right. Stephen nods, smiling off. Gentleman, patriot, scholar, and judge of imposters. Private call. I don't give a bugger who he is. Private Compton, we don't give a bugger who he is. Stephen, I seem to annoy them. Green rag to a bull. You know, in a bullfight, you have a rag, a red rag to a bull. But a green rag would be an Irish rag, and bull here is John Bull, the personification of Ireland. That brings up a memory of King Egan in Paris that we read about. Bloom remembered his stay in Paris with an Irish rebel in exile in black fantastic shirt and Peeper Day's hat. Peeper Day's were Irish rebels who attacked in the morning by Peep of Day. That's the best moment at the end of the night. Kevin Evers, hello, bonjour. Because he spoke French. La vieille ogresse with the donjon, that is what somebody in a Paris journalist said about Queen Victoria, and we heard that in the third chapter. Patrice Ego peeps from behind, his rabbit face nibbling a quince leaf. We had him before lapping milk. Patrice, socialist, he became a socialist. And then as a strange figure, that comes here, you see it from the Don Emil Patricio, that is a kind of Spanish derivation of Patrick, from Rupert Pope Hennessy. It's a complicated carriage, and he's in Needle Hoburg. Two wild geese follow on his helm. He has a coat of arms and wild geese. Volant is a heraldic for flying wild geese. Wild geese is the name for those Irish noble, the aristocracy, Catholic, who, when the Protestants took over, flew to Europe. They were called and often had very high positions. So, with noble indicating points, a mailed hand against the private. And then he says, in mixed language, obviously, he doesn't speak, werf those eyes, throw those eyes to footboarden. Big grand porcos, so speaking, of Johnny Zello's tortoise covered of gravy. So he speaks a kind of a mixed language which you don't quite follow. Bloom, to Stephen, come home. You'll get into trouble, Stephen's way. I don't avoid it. He provokes my intelligence. And then you have again Biddy the clap. One immediately observes that he is of a patrician lineage. Again, strange for Biddy the clap. Then we have the virago. The virago is based on the Latin word vir. It's a woman, usually a very attractive, not young one, who looks like a man. It's not a compliment. Green above the red, says he. This is the Irish green above the red, the colour of soldiers. Wolf Tone, who was a famous rebel who was executed. We have heard of him before. The board. The red's as good as the green and better, because for the prostitution people, the red, the soldiers, they brought money and business. Up the soldiers, up King Edward. A rough loss. Hands up to De Wet. De Wet was the Boer general. You know, the Boers, South African, Dutch speaking, they fought against the British in the Boer War. And De Wet was the Boer general. And the Irish, of course, sympathized with the Boers who were attacked by the British Empire. The citizen from Cyclops with a huge emerald muffler and shillelagh, the kind of club called. May the god above send down a dove, it should be dove, not cow, with teeth as sharp as razors to slip the throat of the English dogs that hung their Irish leaders. Is that where we stopped?
Again, two lands.
Is it? Okay, I'll stop.
Read until the crappy boy.
Can we go on from here?
Barber, accompanied by two black masked assistants, advances with a Gladstone bag, which he opens.
Ladies and gents, cleaver, purchased by Mrs. Percy to slay Mog. Knife with which Voisin dismembered the wife of a compatriot and hid the remains in the sheet in the cellar. The unfortunate female's throat being cut from ear to ear. File containing arsenic retrieved from the body of Miss Barrow, which then set into the gallows.
He jerks the rope. The assistants leap at the victim's legs and drag him downward, grunting. The croppy boy's tongue protrudes violently. The croppy boy.
Hurrah, hooray, hurrah's hash.
He gives up the ghost. The violent erection of the hand sends gouts of sperm spouting through his death clothes onto the cobblestones. Mrs. Bellingham, Mrs. Yelverton Barry, and the Honourable Mrs. Mervyn Tallboys rush forward with their handkerchiefs to sop it up. Rumbled,
I'm near it myself,
he undoes the noose.
Rope which hanged the awful rebel, 10 shillings a time is applied to his royal highness.
He plunges his head into the gaping belly of the hand and draws out his head again, clotted with coiled and smoking entrails.
My painful duty's now been done. God save the king.
Edward VII dances slowly, solemnly, rattling his bucket, and sings with soft contentment.
On coronation day, on coronation day, oh, won't we have a merry time, drinking whiskey, beer, and wine.
Private Carr.
Here, what are you saying about my king?
Stephen throws up his hands.
Oh, this is too monotonous. Nothing. He wants my money and my life, though once must be his master for some brutish empire of his.
Money I haven't.
He searches his pockets vaguely.
Gave it to someone.
Private Carr.
Who wants your bleeding money?
Stephen tries to move off.
Will someone tell me where I am least likely to meet these necessary evils? Ça se voit aussi à Paris. Not that I, but by St. Patrick.
The women's heads coalesce. Old gummy granny in sugarloaf hat appears seated on a toadstool, the death flower of the potato blight on her breast. Stephen.
Aha, I know you, Grammar. Hamlet, revenge, the old sow that eats her farrow.
Old gummy granny, rocking to and fro.
Ireland's sweetheart, the king of Spain's daughter, Alanna. Stranger in my house, bad manners to them.
She keens with banshee woe.
A hone, silk of the kind.
She wails.
You met with poor old Ireland, and how does she stand?
Stephen.
How do I stand you? The hat-trick. Where's the third person of the Blessed Trinity? Sagar de Rune? The Reverend Carrion Crow?
Sissy Caffrey shrill.
Stop them from fighting!
A rough.
El men retreated!
Private Carr, tugging at his belt.
I'll wring the neck of any bugger says a word against my fucking king.
Bloom, terrified. He said nothing, not a word. A pure misunderstanding. the citizen, Aaron Gabrah. Major Tweedy and the citizen exhibit to each other medals, decorations, trophies of war, wounds. Both salute with fierce hostility. Private Compton,
go it, Harry. Do him one in the eye. He's a pro bower.
Stephen, did I? When? Bloom, to the Redcoats, we fought for you in South Africa. Irish missile troops. Isn't that history? Royal Dublin Fusiliers, honoured by our monarch? The Navvy, staggering past.
Oh, yes. Oh, God, yes. I'll make the choir a crower. Oh, bow.
Cast halberdiers in armour, thrust forward a pentis of gutted spear points. Major Tweedy, moustached like Turco the Terrible, in bearskin cap, with hackle plume and accoutrements, with epaulettes, gilt chevrons, and sabretash, his breast bright with medals, toes the line. He gives the pilgrim warrior sign of the Knights Templars. Major Tweedy growls gruffly,
Rockstrift, up guards and anum, Mahal Shalal has mouth.
Private Carr,
I'll do him in.
Private Compton waves the crowd back,
fair play here, make a bleeding butcher's shop with a bugger.
Mass bands blare Gary Owen and God Save the King. Sissy Caffrey,
they're going to fight for me.
Cunty Kate,
the brave and the fair.
Biddy the Clap,
methinks yon sable knight will joust it with the best.
Cunty Kate, blushing deeply,
nay, madam, the ghoul's doublet and merry St. George for me.
Stephen,
the harlot's cry from street to street shall weave old Ireland's winding sheet.
Private Carr, loosening his belt, shouts,
I'll wring the neck of any fucking bastard says a word against my bleeding fucking king.
Bloom shakes Sissy Caffrey's shoulders. Speak, you. Are you struck dumb? You are the link between nations and generations. Speak, woman, sacred life-giver. Sissy Caffrey, alarmed, seizes Private Carr's sleeve.
Am it I with you? Am it I your girl? Sissy's your girl,
she cries.
Police!
Stephen ecstatically to Sissy Caffrey.
White thy fambles, red thy gan, and thy quorum's dainty is.
Voices,
police!
Distant voices,
Dublin's burning! Dublin's burning! On fire! On fire!
Yeah, go back to the croppy boy after the song. The croppy boy in the song who would have been executed. The rope noosed round his neck, so he is being hanged. Gripes in his issuing bowels with both hands. I bear no hate to a living thing. That is from the song The Crobby Boy, who says, I have nothing against the king, but I love Ireland above England, but I love my country beyond the king. Then you have Rumbled Demon Barber. When Joyce had his court case against Private Carr, he even appealed to the British ambassador, Rumbold, in Bern, who, of course, didn't care about, after the war and all the business, didn't care about a lawsuit about price of a pair of trousers. And so Joyce makes him a hangman, Rumbold, Demon Barber, accompanied by two Blackmore's assistants, advances with a Gladstone bag, which he opens. Ladies and gents, Cleve purchased, and this is a bit like the hangman's letters in Cyclops, a hangman, in a way, giving his credentials. Cleaver, butcher's news, Cleaver, was purchased by Mrs. Purton to slay Morg. These would be well-known murder cases. A knife with its wasn't a dismembered the wife of a compatriot and hid remains in a sheet in the cellar. The unfortunate female's throat being cut from ear to ear. Vial containing arsenic retrieved from the body of his burrow, which sent him to the gallows. So these are, I think, real murder cases. He jerks the rope. The assistant leaps at the victim's legs and drag him downward. I think a hanging, I think it goes like that. You stand on some kind of wooden thing that can be opened and then you drop. But you're not always dead, I've been told. And sometimes they have to pull your body to make the job. It's a very unpleasant idea. But downward, grunting. The croppy boy's down protrudes violently. The croppy boy sings, "Ho ho, the ray, ho, rollerblast." And this is with, of course, your strangled neck saying, "Forgot to pray for his mother's rest." So this is the kind of strangled language that you have. Then he gives up the ghost. A violent erection of the hand said, and we've already heard in Cyclops that when there is a hanging, a violent death, it results in an erection with a semen being sent out. A violent rejection of the hand sent gouts of sperm spouting through his death clothes onto the cobblestones. Then Mrs. Bellingham, Mrs. Wilbur Barry, and the honour of Miss Mary Talbot, these are the imagined ladies that accused Bloom of sending them obscene letters. They now rush forward with a handkerchief to sop it up. Then Rumbled says, "I'm near myself." He undoes the noose. Rope which hanged the awful Bremel. Hangman's ropes were often sold afterwards. 10 shilling a time as applied to his royal highness. He plunges his head into gaping belly of the hanged and draws out his head again cloppered with coiled and smoking entrails. "My painful duty has now been done. God save the king." Again, imagine that wouldn't have gone down too well in Great Britain if anyone had been allowed to sell it. Now again, Edward VII dances slowly, solemnly, rattling his bucket and sings with soft containment. Obviously, that's a song that was done on his own coronation. That isn't so far back. And it should be sung probably as a Cockney accent on coronation day, because he won't have a merry time drinking whiskey dinner. This was already intoned by Buck Mulligan in the first chapter. Private Carl, "Here, what are you saying about my king?" Stephen throws up his hands. "Oh, this is too monopolous, nothing. He wants my money and my life. Though, want must be his master. Want must be his master, that is a proverb, want to be his master. For some brutish empire, the British Empire becomes a brutish empire of his. Money I haven't." He stirs his pocket vaguely. "Give it to someone." "Who wants your bleeding money?" Stephen tries to move off. "Will someone tell me where I am least likely to meet these necessary evils?" Sacerdotia Barry. "Not that I, but by St. Patrick." And by St. Patrick is sworn by Hamlet's father's, the king's, dead king's ghost. By Hamlet, by St. Patrick. It's strange that Hamlet would swear in an Irish way. Forget what I said before. The women's heads coalesce to become one. Old Gummy Granny, a kind of first ornification of Ireland. In Sugarloaf, half the pier seat on a toadstool. That is like witches. They have these hats and sit on a toadstool. The death flower of the potato blight from the breast. The potato blight, you know, the disaster of the potato crop during the famine in the 1940s that reduced Ireland to a big disaster in Irish history. "Stephen Mahal, I know you, Gamma Grammar. Hamlet revenge, that's what the ghost says. The old sow that eats her farrow, that's a word that Stephen in the portrait, the book before, said, Ireland is the old sow that eats her farrow. Farrow is the young pigs. Ferkel is the German expression. Oh, dummy grimy, rocking to and fro, Ireland sweetheart, the King of Spain's daughter, Alana. Hamlet revenge. The king, I had a little nut tree, nothing would you bear, but the silver nut and the golden pear. The King of Spain's daughter came to visit me. So the King of Spain's daughter is from a nursery rhyme, Alana. Strangers in my house, the foreigners. Bad manners to them, bad luck to them. She keens, keen is the song of the women when somebody has died. With banshee, well, the banshee, these are women banshee, and when the banshee rode, then somebody is dying. O'Cone, that is, oh my grief in Irish. Silk of the kine is an old word for Ireland. Again, we had that in the third chapter. She wails. You met with poor old Ireland, how now does she stand? That is from an Irish song, The Wearing of the Green. You met with poor old Ireland, that is now she stands. So that is one of these patriotic songs. Stephen, how do I stand you? The hat trick again. Where's the third person of the Blessed Trinity? So he talks theology to them. Socket the rune, that you're the priest and the priest and I, my beloved priest, it is a title of a song, another Irish song. Socket is an Irish priest. The Reverend Carrion Crow is something from Flaubert. A carrion crow set on a nook. So, which is complicated too, I can't go into it. City cow shrill, stop them from fighting. Rough our man retreated in military language. Private car, tugging at his belt. I'll wring the neck of any bugger says a word against my fucking king. Boom, terrified. He said nothing, not a word, a pure misunderstanding. And the citizens, Erin go brawl, Ireland forever. Major Tweedy and the citizen, Major Tweedy, Bloom's father-in-law, against the citizen, so it's England against Ireland, exhibit to each other medals, decorations, trophies of war, wounds. Both salute with fierce hostility. Private Compton. Do it, Harry. Do it in one in the eye. He's a pro-Boer for the Boers who fought against England. Did I? When? Luther Drake. We fought for you in the South African Irish missile troops. Isn't that history? Because Irish troops also fought for England against the Boers. Royal Dublin Fusiliers, honoured by our monarch. This is a famous regiment. The Navy staggering. Oh, yes. Oh, God, yes. Oh, makes the quarrel a pro-Boer, probably. I don't know what they have here. Oh, nothing. Make the somebody, the Boer, a pro-Boer. Oh, then caught Halbert, yes. Halbert, Hele Barde, in armor thrust for the pentage of gutted spear points. Major Tweedy, moustached like Turk or the Terrible, in bursting cap with hack and plume, and accoutrements with epaulette, gilt chevrons and saber toss, his breast high with medals, toes the line. So it's like a fight. He gives a pilgrim's warrior sign of the Knights Templars. It's another Freemason sign. Major Tweedy, Roger, Rorke's Drift. There was a battle at Rorke's Drift. No. Up guards and atom That is said to be Wellington's command to shoot up guards and at them. And then Mahalswaral House was it from a kind of magic trick book that seems to say, make haste to pray, fall upon the spoils. But it looks like a kind of mock Arabic secret formula. I'll do him in. Welcome. Waves the crowd back. Fair play here. Make a bleeding butcher shop of the bugger. Master band player Gary Owen, that's an Irish song, and God Save the King. Ireland against England again. Tissy Caffrey, they're going to fight for me. County Kate, the brave and the fair. This is a song, the brave and the fair, based on none but the brave deserve the fair, the brave soldier and the fair woman. Edith claps, and again she speaks in a medieval kind of thing. Methinks yon sable knight will joust it with the best. Sable knight is, sable is heraldic black. The knight will joust. Joust is a medieval tournament with the best. And County Kate, blushing deep, nay, madam, the ghoul's doublet and Mary St. George for me. Ghoul's doublet, ghoul is red, heraldic, against black, doublet and Mary St. George for me. So she is on the side of St. George in Britain, and Biddy the Clap is on the Irish side. Stephen, he repeats what he thought in the morning in the second chapter. The harlot's cry from street to street shall weave old Ireland's winding sheet. This is a Blake quotation, but Blake and Stephen in the morning said old England's winding sheet is now changed to old Ireland. Private Carr, loosening his belt, shouts, I wring the neck of any fucking bastard as a bird against my bleeding fucking king. And you can see this is, for the time of Ulysses, was very, very tabooed language that was unprintable. And it's very strong. But Hugh Kenner, one of the best critics, has said, of course, that's very coarse, bleeding fucking king. But of course, British royalty, as you know, they were bleeders, they were hemophiles. They bleed easily. That was part of him. And fucking, and the Prince of Wales and the King Edward, they were womanizing. So these are not just coarse swear words, that they're actually appropriate. Bloom shakes stiffly Caffrey's shoulders. Speak, you. Are you struck dumb? You are the link between nations and generations. Speak, woman, sacred life-giver. Sissy Caffrey, alarmed, seizes Private Carr's sleeve. I'm there with you. I'm there, your girl. Sissy's your girl. She cries, police. And Stephen, ecstatically to Sissy Caffrey, white thy farmers, red thy dam, and thy corn's date is. this is a gypsy language that Stephen had in the first. Fambles is, I think, fingers, thy gar is face, and thy quarrens, thy body is attractive. Now, of course, when you speak to soldiers who want to knock you down, you answer in gypsy language that they wouldn't understand, wouldn't be the best policy. So Stephen is quite unalert. He doesn't realize anything. And voices say, police, Dublin's burning, on fire. And we know that there was a fire at the end of the last chapter. And now we stop here because you can see the next paragraph is very long and should be read together. And it also seems that next time we might finish this long, long chapter. And for some of us, it might come as a bit of a relief. But you've been very brave following here now. And I'm often very uncertain what should be said. So we'll be doing our best. Okay, next week then.
Bye-bye.
Bye.